Welcome to The Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Joanne, and today I will be reading from The Summer Club by Hannah McKinnon. This is episode 3. Ned smiled. We've got a new generation here we're trying to cultivate. Cultivate? Dick screwed up his face like he had been hit with a used diaper. What are we, some kind of new age artsy learning center for kids? He's looking around him at the other board members. I thought we were a country club. Ned bit his lip. We're an association of folks who hopefully become lifelong golfers, tennis players, Dick. That takes cultivation. Dick said nothing. He leaned back in his seat, stretching lazily as if he were lounging in his own home theater. Dick was taking pleasure in watching Ned squirm. So, aside from kitty camp, we've got the equivalent of 1.5 new memberships. Ned had had enough from Dick, which leads me to membership concerns. He lifted up the pilgrim box and shook it. Since we put this out for comment, it's been filling up. He ignored Neiman Shreve's eye roll. There are a few that stood out, which I like to share with the board. As soon as Ned read the member comment questioning the pilgrim mogul, heads swiveled. What's wrong with a pilgrim? Art O'Connor barked. He represents courage and strength. Bitsy Babcock wagged a finger. Notice you just said he? We also have vibrant female membership here. I think that's what this member is getting at. From there, the conversation careened out of Ned's control. So slap a woman pilgrim on the sign. Did they wear those wide-brim hats, too? So now you're villainizing pilgrims? I don't see how anyone can be offended. Do we even have any Native American members? We do have membership with Mayflower lineage. Is that where the name Mayhaven came from? Just cancel the pilgrim. That's what the young members want, isn't it? To cancel everything? Ned had to clap his hands over the uproar. Clearly, this member's comment raises a lot of questions. As such, I suggest we table this conversation for further review. Dick Delancey shook his head. Great, we're going to take down the pilgrim, a logo we've had since the club's inception, just because some woke mom got her a tennis skirt and a twist. Shall we also give trophies to everyone at the next golf scramble while we're at it? And just like that, everyone was shouting again. Ned wished he had a gavel. His hands were raw from clapping by the time the table quieted down. All right. Clearly this is a matter that requires further consideration. There was a disgruntled vote to table discussion for a special session. There was one more issue before they could adjourn. Where are things on the pond regeneration? Teddy Winter asked. Is it ready for fish? Ned felt the familiar tug of an oncoming eye twitch. For a water feature intended to be serene and healing, thus far the pond had imparted nothing but angst. The pond was located on the 9th hole, once the most picturesque hole on the course, but over time the retaining wall had begun to leak. Filtration system had clogged, and due to aquatic imbalances, the fish pond had eventually turned muddy and fishless. Unlike other recent projects that raised assessment fees without providing any immediate aesthetic pleasure, the pond rejuvenation was highly visible. Members liked seeing what they were paying for, and it was by far the most visually appealing improvement of the year. But due to setbacks unforeseen and plentiful, the project had been delayed and run over budget. If there was anything Ned wanted to wrap up, it was the darn pond. Dick Delancey brightened for the first time at the mention of the pond. As you all know, my darling daughter, Phoebe, is getting married here this summer. We plan to take family wedding photos at the pond. My wife, Coral, had an affinity for water features. Unsurprisingly, Phoebe was much a character as her parents. Since she had been a teen, darling Phoebe had pilfered drinks from the bar, screamed at the tennis pro in front of everyone any time she missed a shot. As for Coral, last he heard, the front end of her Bentley was still dinged by some errant caddy who must have hit it with a golf cart after the Memorial Day dinner dance. There was never a mention of the 100-year-old oak tree at the clubhouse entrance with a side mirror sticking out of its trunk, nor the Delancey bar tab that evening to the tune of 7 whiskey sours. In addition to the aforementioned water features, Coral also had an affinity for Jack Daniels. "Good news," Ned said. "The project is nearly done. Our aquatic specialist informs me that the plant life has taken hold and the pond is finally ready to sport fish." The announcement caused a happy ripple across the table.
"When do the fish come?"
Ned smiled. This was the best part. "We have ordered a very special variety of rare koi. The hatchery has scheduled a delivery for 2 weeks from tomorrow."
Betsy clapped her hands together. "How wonderful. What kind of koi are they?"
"Hikari mono," Ned said, hoping he pronounced it correctly. "Hikari mono," the board echoed with the table. More resounding cheers. Ned doubted that a single one of them had any clue what hikari mono were. Until last week's conference call with the hatchery, he sure as hell had not. He looked at Dick. "Now, your daughter and wife will be relieved to know that the koi are beautiful and on their way. We're expecting 200 of them."
200, someone said.
Dick Delancey tapped his pen loudly against the table. "If only your membership numbers were so high." New chapter, Darcy. She wasn't hungry for dinner, but she was for information. Ever since he'd flashed her a smile in the hallway, she couldn't get the boy from the club out of her head. "Flick," he'd said when he introduced himself. Flick was cute, though nothing like Spencer Delaney. Let's be clear. Spencer was blonde and broad and chiseled. Textbook Ken doll. Flick was more boyish. His dark hair was cut short, his skin the color of her favorite iced coffee. He looked more like a little lost standing under the chandelier in the foyer, and his clothes had been all wrong for the club. But that smile. "So how was camp today?" her mother asked too brightly as they all sat down to eat. Darcy blinked. She was beat from a long day with the little people, and she really did not feel like regaling her mother with the exacting recap she seemed to require these days, ever since she started working at the realty office, instead of being normal and plunking herself in front of the Bravo Chiana with a glass of wine like Lily's mom did. And she didn't even have a job. Ingrid Birch came home and cooked elaborate dinners and insisted on family time. She knew her mother wanted to spend time together, but Darcy wanted to be left alone. It was an exhausting dance. "Darcy, honey, I asked how camp went," her mother repeated. "Fine," she replied, shoving a giant forkful of salad into her mouth because her mother could ask a follow-up question. In addition to pushing houses and aggressively parenting, Ingrid was working on communicating with her teens. The other night, Darcy had come downstairs to make popcorn, and caught her mother bent over the laptop. When Darcy peered over her shoulder, she caught the headline of the article she was reading. "Talking to your teen, making the most of a reluctant conversation partners." She had to bite her tongue. Her mom had glanced up wearily, then back at her screen. "Marianne says we need to help Adam engage in conversations." Marianne was Adam's speech pathologist, but Darcy secretly wondered if the article had more to do with her. She loved her mother, but sometimes Ingrid was so... Ingrid. As she waited for the popcorn to pop, Darcy couldn't help but scan the article. "Be sure to ask open-ended questions of your teen. Open-ended questions invite more detailed answers than those disappointing one-word replies, the killers of conversation." Why did adults feel the need to complicate everything? Maybe like her, Adam didn't feel like talking sometimes. Now, Ingrid blinked expectantly at her over her untouched plate. "Just fine?" Ingrid should probably reread that article. She hadn't learned to ask open-ended questions yet. Darcy turned to her father, who had no excuse to look as tired as he did. At least he'd spent his day in air conditioning instead of chasing kids with sunscreen and bug spray.
"So, Dad, you had an interview?"
Her father nodded. "Yes, for kitchen help.
He took a bite without offering anything more. Dusty tried again. Seemed like a nice guy. This got her father's attention. You know him? Not really. I ran into him in the hallway, and he showed me where... and showed him where your office was. Her dad cocked his head. Did you recognize him? Hadn't she just said that they just met in the hallway? Maybe her father should read that article, too. Should I have? Her father set his fork down. So, I had a little surprise at work. This cheered her mother right up. Darcy could read the double bubble over Ingrid's head. Finally, some information. Turns out my interview was with our new neighbor, Flick Creevy. Her father shrugged. He seemed like a nice kid, decent candidate. It's too bad, really. None of this was making sense. Darcy knew all about the new neighbors. She heard the late-night music. She'd seen their obnoxious RV. She even smelled pot wafting from their yard one night. No one had mentioned a teenage boy. That she would have remembered. Flick is our neighbor? Darcy reeled. A cute boy from the hallway had not applied for a job at Mayhead, but also lived next door. She pushed her chair back. I can't believe this. Wait, where are you going? Her mother stammered, looking in alarm at her full plate. Why didn't you guys tell me? Darcy cried. Off all the meaningless things that he talked about, no one had thought to mention a new teenage neighbor. Her father was looking at her funny. I thought we did. Besides, I only met him briefly that night I went over there to welcome him to the neighborhood. That night? It was all our parents had talked about in hushed tones since the big neighbor Stan, his big RV, and the big slam in her father's face. All interesting intel, but not exactly relevant to Darcy. Like an open snap on Snapchat, fleeting and instantly replaced by the next. Still, someone could have mentioned a teenage boy. Flick Creevy, Adam said, looking up from his dinner. He moved in 10 days ago. He drives a 2013 Chevy Malibu. Yep, Adam had been listening. That's right, the mother said. How did you know his car is a 2013? Have you met him, too? Adam shook his head. Darcy pulled her chair back in. So, are you giving him the job? If Flick was going to be working at Mayhaven with her each day, she'd like to know. This seemed to weigh on her father. It's complicated. Well, I sure hope he's more polite than his stepfather, her mother said, standing up. She's the only one with a clean plate. When Adam tried to stand up, too, she said, lemon meringue for dessert for those who eat their dinner. Adam plopped back down in his chair. Chevy Malibus have been produced since 1964. The 327 V8 had 300 horsepower. Adam took a bite of his dinner and continued with his mouth full. It was raised to 350 in 1965. Their father smiled. How do you know all that? Adam took another bite. I like Flick's car. I looked it up on YouTube. If he drives, he has a license, which means he's at least 16. She looked at his sister. You're 16, too. Darcy rolled her eyes. Even Adam knew more about Flick than she did. But their father was already changing the subject. Do you know your grandfather had a Chevy, too, Adam? It was a red Chevelle. Adam froze in concentration. Chevelle, what year? I don't know for sure, but I was a kid when he got it. Must have been 75 or 76. Adam pushed his chair back. I'm looking it up. Dessert, their mother barked from the kitchen sink and slumped back down. Darcy knew exactly how he felt. So back to the interview, she prompted. Was she being too obvious? Luckily, her mother was even nosier. Yes, you said you're desperate for kitchen help, so what makes you so unsure about Flick Creevy? The situation next door. The situation? It sounded so dramatic, especially from someone as old as her father. The RV, Adam said decisively. The RV is the situation. They all gazed toward the window that looked out on the driveway, and the behemoth RV is still there, her father said, gripping his napkin. But surely you can't hold that against Flick, her mother said. It was one thing Darcy and her mother agreed on. Yeah, he can't help it if his stepfather was an a-hole, she added. Swear jar, Adam leapt out of his seat and ran to the kitchen counter. A-hole is hardly a swear. Adam plunked the jar down on the table. Times two. He's right, her mother said. Darcy looked at her father, who rubbed his eyes wearily. Times two. If he's a good candidate, it's only fair to give Flick the job. She wondered if Flick would be going to her high school. Based on the high-end cars in the driveway and the gleaming RV, they had money. Maybe he'd gone to Wharton Prep like so many of the other kids at the club. She was glad Spencer Delancey didn't go to Wharton. I'll think about it, her father said, rising slowly from the table. He looked exhausted, so Darcy let it go. Adam leaned across the table and jingled the swear jar under her nose. He said he's going to think about it. Now pay up. Up in her room, Darcy opened her closet door and pushed the hangers of clothes aside so she could see better. The back of the closet floor was where she tossed things she didn't want, like old shoes or out-of-fashion purses. Hidden among them was an old duffel bag. It was what was in the duffel bag that she was after. As she knelt, she saw a flicker of gold. Shoved against the far side of the closet were her trophies, toppled over and half-covered by discarded clothes. Darcy sat on her haunches and regarded them. There were only a handful of the many she'd won over the years. The others her father stored on a shelf in his study downstairs, alongside his own from his youth. Hesitantly, she reached for the largest trophy, the one she hated most. It was from last October, when she'd won the Junior New England Championship at Shuttle Meadow Golf Club, the last tournament she played and the hardest one fought for. Just holding the weight of the trophy in her hands brought back the memory of the day. Surrounded by hills, woods, and streams, Shuttle Meadow had been challenging, but Vince had reminded her that she used to be the very terrain of Mayhaven, and Darcy went in feeling strong. Despite that, she had not started well. On the first two holes, she double bogeyed and was behind the leader by 5 strokes. She parred the next, but the pattern went on, and she finished in a lousy 4th place. Maya Leigh, who led by 7 strokes by the end of the first day, had run into her at the buffet under the big white tent that evening. Darcy appreciated Maya beyond her obvious skill. She was low-key and friendly, no matter how good or bad she played. "Congrats," she told Maya. "It's just one day," Maya said, winking. "Tomorrow you'll be coming for me, along with the rest of them." It was true. You wanted to start strong, but for the mental edge more than anything. But Darcy had played long enough to know that on the second day, leaders could have their edge swept away with just one bad drive or missed putt. Once the technical stuff crept in, so too did the shaking of confidence. Darcy still had a chance to catch her. But to her chagrin, the next day she started out just as she had the first, inconsistent in her irons and unable to secure that feeling she got when her nerves settled and her muscle memory took over. "Shake it off and start fresh on the next hole," Vince had coached. "You play your best when you're having fun. Imagine we're back at Mayhaven, just practicing." He was right, and she tried to follow his advice, but then she sliced the ball into the trees on the 4th hole. When she passed her parents standing in a crowd along the fairway, Darcy couldn't bring herself to make eye contact with her father. It wasn't just Vince. It was her father who she really wanted to make proud. But then something happened when she made the turn. Her irons, which had been troubling her all morning, settled into her grip as if they were extensions of her own arms. Suddenly, the ball was flying off her clubs. She crushed her next 3 drags. With her nerves settling, Darcy found her rhythm, and by the final hole of the day, Darcy was 1 stroke behind a new leader, Ellis Quinn, with Meyer now in 3rd. On her last putt, Ellis choked. Darcy made an eagle. When she looked up and saw her father's face in the crowd, it was one of the best moments of her life. What followed after the awards ceremony that night was one of the worst. Now, hands shaking with anger, Darcy shoved the trophy back into the closet. She grabbed the black duffel bag and unzipped it. At the bottom was a green plastic jar she'd been looking for. She unscrewed the jar of weight loss pills and tipped a handful of capsules into her hands. Their bright yellow color was hope. Summer sunshine. She discovered them on TikTok, thanks to an influencer she admired for her taut midriff and effortless style. Despite the fact she was Darcy's age, she looked eons more sophisticated. Worldly, sexy, the influencer claimed she'd been taking those pills for just 1 month and was already down 15 pounds. It was that easy. It was even easier to buy them at the link provided, no questions asked. The bottle came 3 days later, and though she worried her parents might see it, everyone was so distracted with their own problems that summer that no one in her family noticed. She beat them to the mailbox and hid the bottle in her room. That was less than a week ago. She lost 2 pounds already. Pills made her feel jittery, and she peed a lot, but it was no big deal. Directions called for one capsule each day. Darcy paused before popping two in her mouth and taking a long swig from her water bottle. Then she shoved the duffel bag back into her closet, beneath the clothes and shoes and purses, where her nosy mother wouldn't find it and her father wouldn't think to look. When she went to the mirror, she imagined a new girl staring back at her with the same green eyes, a girl who didn't think about trophies or the game or the look on her father's face that day, a girl who didn't miss the weight of her four iron in her hand or the sun on her back as she surveyed the fairway from the highest point on the course. Darcy tucked a strand of stray curl behind her ear. She wondered how long it would take until it felt that way for real. New chapter, Flick. Flick was lying in bed thinking about two things. The fact that the stupid job at the club was something he might actually want, and the girl. What was going on behind those green eyes when she smiled? His phone dinged. It was his best friend from home, Mateo. Mateo had texted him each night since Flick had moved away. The texts weren't long or particularly interesting, but they were comforting. A small lifeline back home to Queens. A link to who Flick was in the strange wooded world of Massachusetts suburbia. What's up? Nothing. Get that job? No, man, not my scene. Why? Rich white people scene. Well, now you got the rich white thing going for you. Shut up. A moment later, his phone dinged again. Flick stared at the strange number before opening the text. Hi, Flick. Ned Birch here. It was nice meeting you with you. The job is yours if you want it. Flick stared at the screen to make sure he read it right. Wait until his mother heard this. Wait until Mateo did. He barely hesitated before replying. Thanks, Mr. Birch. I would like the job. There was a pause, followed by a line of dots, and Ned texted back. Flick held his breath. I'd hoped you'd say that. Go look on your doorstep. Flick jumped downstairs, past the living room where his mother and Stan were watching TV, and pulled the front door open. There, folded neatly on the steps, was a blue polo shirt. Flick lifted it up. On the right breast was the May Haven Pilgrim logo. Mommy called out, holding it up. Guess what? Josie stared at the shirt with a look of confusion until Flick pointed to the logo. I got the job. You got it? Oh, my God, you got it. She leapt off the couch and hugged him hard. Stan managed to pull his gaze away from the screen long enough to grunt congrats. Wait, where'd the shirt come from? His mother wanted to know. Were you saving this as a surprise? No, Flick shook his head. Mr. Birch must have dropped it off. Birch? Stan practically choked on his chip he was eating. Are you telling me that guy works at the club? He snorted. Makes sense. So uptight and all. Josie looked confused. Our neighbor, Mr. Birch, works there too? Yeah, he's my boss. She looked to Stan. Why do you say he's uptight? Stan shrugged. I've seen him around. So he hadn't told Josie about the night he slammed the door in Mr. Birch's face. You're going to have to be nicer, Stan, Josie said, especially since Flick works for him now. Nicer. I'm like the nicest guy around. Look at all the happy customers I served all those years. All those old ladies. All those suits. The way he talked, you'd think Stan had served his country. Josie wasn't having it, but she did walk over and place her hands lovingly on either side of his big face. Baby, no one here knows who the dry cleaning king is. You're new. We're all new. Let's play nice. Back upstairs, Flick tucked off his T-shirt and tried on the polo. It was a perfect fit. How did Ned Birch know his size? Moreover, how did Ned Birch know he'd take the job? He texted Mateo back. Guess what? What? You're talking to the new kitchen assistant at the country club. There was a big, long pause. Then his phone dinged. Don't turn into an a-hole. Flick smiled. No chance. His phone dinged again. And don't screw it up. There were two shifts each day at Mayhaven, lunch service and dinner. And for his first day, Flick would be working the lunch shift. On his way out, Josie stopped him for a good look. Look at my little working man, so handsome. If Mateo could have seen him, he'd have ribbed him endlessly. Ned had said navy and khaki were staff uniform and that they'd provide the shirt. Flick figured navy blue would be good for hiding stains in the kitchen, but he was a little worried about the khaki. Luckily, he did have one nice pair of beige pants from his mother and Stan's wedding ceremony, so he'd thrown those to the pair of Doc Converse sneakers. The whole way to the club, his stomach fluttered. The first thing he noticed as he traipsed up the walkway with a cluster of kids playing on the tennis courts, filing down the hill in swimsuits, finger painting at the picnic table under a white tent. Little kids were everywhere, and so were the teenagers who worked with them. Flick scanned their faces, trying to locate the girl from the hallway the day before. Darcy, she'd said. There were a couple of what Mateo would call chads standing around instead of working, a handful of girls at the painting table, and a pretty blonde who laughed too loudly, but no sign of Darcy. Inside the clubhouse was a stark contrast to the noise and energy outside. Flick trotted down the quiet hall, past the trophy case of serious faces, to Mr. Birch's office. Mr. Birch looked up from his computer and grinned widely. Was this guy always this happy? You made it, he said. Flick wondered if there had been doubt. Yes, sir, Flick paused in the doorway. Shall I go up to the kitchen? Yes. Mossimo wants to start you out gently with lunch service. Once you get your sea legs, he'll move you up to dinner. Flick nodded. But, on occasion, there may be a need for you to fill in elsewhere. You may drive the drink cart out on the course or work the snack shack down the lake. Sound good? The drink cart sounded good to him, and the lake sounded really good. He hoped there would be some cute girls in bikinis, not just the older ladies he'd seen around so far. Mossimo was pretty much what Flick had expected, meticulous and demanding. Not that his demands were unreasonable, there were just a lot of them. Clean workstations, timely prep, remembering the regulars, the recipes that were served almost nightly, seafood chowder, baby beet salad, the grilled focaccia with heirloom tomatoes. That's kitchen life, Mossimo would sing out not happily across the kitchen when swiping carrot peels off an untidy prep counter, holding them up in the fist. Keep your stations clear. Clean workstations were just the beginning. Because the staff was small, everyone was on deck, whether you had a culinary chops or not. You would mop floors, do shelf inventory, you would chop vegetables, and even prepare sauces. Today we start with beurre blanc. Mossimo had to be crazy. The closest thing Flick had made to a beurre blanc was a package of powdered béarnaise sauce for a steak on Christmas. He was doomed. But there was no time for self-doubt. The chef stood beside him, adding tiny cubes of chilled butter to the simmering wine in the pan. You cannot stop whisking, he explained. If you stop, it won't emulsify. Flick had never used the word in his life, but looking into the bowl concoction in front of him, it was somehow felt familiar. Keep blending until you achieve velvet, Mossimo directed. Flick was not alone. Ricky, the sous chef, worked the more advanced dishes and seemed to be deputy to Mossimo's sheriff. Ricky was lean and wiry and more a band snapback backward, which surprised Flick. Mossimo must really like the guy. Wendy, the head server, he guessed she was in her early 20s, didn't seem to be in charge of much in the kitchen, but clearly ran the show in the dining room and snack shack. Flick watched her chew out a girl who showed up late. He tried to steer clear of Wendy. Joe did dishes in the back, and Flick wondered what else he really saw the guy. While others darted about prepping lunch service, Flick manned his saucepan. Whisking over the gas range meant he had to wipe his forehead repeatedly. If he dripped sweat into the sauce, he was D.O.A. Mossimo popped by twice to check in on the sauce. The first time he just said, "No, I said velvet." The second time he tasted, "Next one, more white wine." But it couldn't have been terrible because it's... He set it aside and told Flick to move on to the salad station. Lunch is a lot of salad. All through lunch, Flick never got a chance to see who was in the dining room or how it was going. The kitchen was full steam. Mr. Flick, I need 2 chicken Caesars. 1 no dressing, Ricky. 1 halibut and 2 Wagyus. For 2 hours, Flick's only job was to assemble salads and man the sauces. But it wasn't easy. Learning to emulsify the beurre blanc Sauce for fish was tricky enough, but if your sauce wasn't ready in time for plating while the halibut was hot out of the pan, into the trash went the cold fish, and off your paycheck it came. That's kitchen life. Get it right. Get it right. Flick wiped his brow, thinking that's what he'd been trying to do since he moved here. Turned out adjusting to small-town life was as complicated as blah blank. 2 o'clock, the order slowed, and the kitchen went from clattering pots to gentler hum. At 2:30, Mosimo announced lunch service was over. Everyone stopped for a beat. There was chatter and relief, followed swiftly by cleanup. As Flick wiped down the salad station and brought his saucepans to the sink, Mosimo found him. "Mr. Flick, good work today." "Thank you," Flick said. He was exhausted, and his feet throbbed. He was pretty sure he didn't smell so great either, but he made it. Almost. "Remember, you're on until 4:30, Ricky said, maneuvering around him with a giant mixing bowl crusted with some kind of dough. There was a lull between lunch and dinner at the club, but sometimes members wandered in for a drink or bar snacks. Apron off and hands washed, Mosimo said, before whisking Flick's apron unceremoniously over his head. There was no lunch served after hours, no exceptions. There was a light snack menu until dinner. Flick's head was already spinning at the idea of taking someone's order and not dropping plates. He never waited tables before. What about the beach snack bar Mr. Birch had to mention? But he was too afraid to ask. Here. Mosimo handed him a printed menu. Charcuterie, small salads, chips, and smoked trout dip. I don't want to see you behind the bar. It is a bartender's zone, not yours. Your zone is kitchen and dining. Got it? Flick wasn't sure he had gotten any of that, really. He looked through the service doors at the mostly empty dining room. There were a couple of older men finishing up their lunch, and that was it. Traffic is light. Pay attention and smile. Flick forced a smile. Got it? We'll see you tomorrow. With Mosimo gone, the kitchen felt instantly lighter. So, Mosimo's done for the day? Ricky laughed. As if. He's going home to rest before dinner service. He's back on from 5 to close. Wow. Flick couldn't imagine the rush of lunch service followed by cleanup and then gearing up to do it all over again into the night. As he scrubbed a pot, Ricky shook his head. Lunch is for lambs, kid. Dinner is for lions. Wait until you do a Saturday night event. It's mayhem. Flick considered this. Are the tips at least good? Yeah, but the demands are high. Don't get me wrong, some of the members are good folks, but some are real a-holes. Flick peered out the porthole window of the service door to the dining floor. Still just the two old men. He should probably go ask. Check, please, one of the men said as Flick approached. Sure thing, sir. Flick cleared their lunch plates carefully, then remembered what Mosimo had said about member tabs. May I have your number, please? The other man looked at him, not unkindly. You're new here. It wasn't a question. Yes, sir. First day. I'm Flick Creevy. Marty Robbins and Jack Gorman. I'm 7720. Put it on mine today. Nice to meet you both, Flick smiled and took their plates to the kitchen as the two embarked on an argument about whose turn it was to pay. As soon as the bill was paid, Marty won. The dining room was empty. Flick was about to find Ricky to ask about setting tables for dinner when he heard the thunder of footsteps coming up the stairs. A group of four guys about his age rounded the corner, talking loudly. Without waiting, they made their way noisily through the dining room and took the corner table by the window overlooking the deck and the course. Flick wiped his hands and made his way over. The boys were still talking, ignoring him. Flick cleared his throat awkwardly. The kitchen is closed for lunch, he said politely, but we're serving bar snacks. The one who led the group in eyed him like he was interrupting their conversation. We're ordering burgers. Had he not heard? I'm sorry, we're closed. He leaned back in the chair and stared right through Flick. He had one of those preppy mops of hair that guys like him flipped out of their eyes by constantly tossing their heads. Hair flippers, Mateo called them. He looked ready to argue, but one of the others, who looked like he played college football, spoke up. You said bar snacks? What do you got for those? Flick held his hands behind his back and recited the list from memory. Charcuterie, pita chips, and smoked trout dip, and mixed salad. Smoked trout, one of the guys laughed. Gross!
It was actually good. Flick had tried it, but he kept that bit to himself. If you want chips, we could substitute guacamole for the trout dip, he said instead. Footballer nodded. Okay, two of those, and also a spring mix salad.
Jesus, Trevor. What are you, watching your figure?
Trevor shrugged good-natured. Gotta keep the girls interested, man. There was some ribbing, and then the half-flipper turned to Flick. You said bar snacks? How about a couple of beers for my friends? Flick felt his chest thump. No way were these guys a day older than he was. Massimo had said card anyone who looks younger than 50. That member, kids get cheeky. But it was the last thing Flick wanted to do. All four boys were staring at him now, waiting to see what he'd do. Flick swallowed. Sure thing. I just need to see an ID. The half-flipper made a faux move to reach for his back pocket.
Damn, left it in the car. Look, I know you're new here, but we're good.
Trevor nudged him. Next time, Spencer. Spencer. So that was the half-flipper's name.
No. We worked hard, boys. We deserve a few brews.
Spencer waited, staring at Flick.
Well, Flick could play this game, too.
He stared back, willing his hands to stay still by his side.
I'm sorry. The boss insists on checking IDs. Oh, he does he? Do you know who I am? Spencer rubbed his chin thoughtfully. No, you don't. You're a newbie.
Flick blinked. The kid was the last person he wanted to know. My father's the chairman of the board, newbie. Does the name Delancey ring a bell? Now, one of the other guys chimed in. Let it go, man. But Spencer wasn't having that kind of guy.
Flick could tell. Look, I have to follow the rules.
No, you look.
Spencer Delancey narrowed his eyes. Rules don't apply to everyone around here. You'll learn.
Flick didn't respond to threats, but he also had a job to do. He wished Massimo was there.
I'll be back with the chips, Flick muttered, turning on his heel.
He shoved through the kitchen doors so hard they swung back on the hinges. Ricky turned around. What's up?
Nothing, Flick lied.
Wiped his hands on his dish towel and went to look through the dung.
Ah, Delancey. He's a little prick. Ignore him.
Flick tried. He served the table their bar snacks and refilled their waters twice, and he almost managed until he got to the bill.
Put it on my tab, Spencer said.
May I have your number, please? Spencer snorted. Number one. No one said anything. Flick wasn't sure if he was serious or not. He paused, his pen hovering over the bill.
Spencer glared at him.
I said number one. Flick handed over the pen, eyes averted, as Spencer scribbled something in the tip line and signed the bill.
My great-grandfather was the first member to join this club. I'm a legacy here. Spencer stood, letting his napkin slip to the floor and pressed the bill hard against Flick's chest.
Don't forget it, newbie. As the group left, laughter following them out of the dinner room, Flick stole a look at the bill. The tip line, $1. The signature line, number one.
New chapter. Ned.
For most people, a Friday night in summer meant a slow pull on a cold beer, a dip in the lake, or a stroll down Main Street for ice cream. For Ned, it meant the busiest part of his week was just beginning. Saturday afternoon was the first golf scramble of the season. Saturday night was a surf and turf dinner at the restaurant. Sunday morning, the course was rented for a private party brunch, and Ned would need to be in attendance at everything. When he pulled into his driveway, he parked in the ominous shadow of his neighbor's RV. Tinged in late-day sun, it shone like a beacon of incivility. Ned chewed his bottom lip. He gazed across the way into the neighbor's backyard. Sure enough, still tied to the base of the tree, was their old Halloween scarecrow Stan had plucked from their trash. It still wore Ned's red Sox t-shirt, or at least what was left of it. Ned shaded his eyes for a better look. Dead center in the scarecrow's chest, two arrows jutted out. Ned needed a beer. He glanced up at his own cheerful front door. Inside, Ingrid and Adam would be waiting for him to join them for dinner. It was Friday, which meant green was the color of the day. There'd be salad or asparagus or chicken with pesto. Darcy was home, too, but likely not for long. Since she was no longer competing in tournaments on weekends, her surplus energies had pivoted sharply to burnishing her social life. The negotiations would begin the moment he walked into the door. Where she wanted to go, who she wanted to go out with, how unfair her curfew was. The debate was never ending. Ingrid would have already been broken down, and she'd be looking to Ted to pass the baton to. how much simpler and happier life was when Darcy was still playing golf. Ned allowed himself one more unassaulted moment alone in his car. He tried to focus on something cheerful. Right in front of him bloomed his prized heirloom rose bushes, looking promising this early in the season. He tried to stay there on the soothing pink-petaled meditation of his roses, but his gaze got away from them, swinging back to the RV like a dog to a bone. There'd be no respite, indoors or out. Hoping to salvage a moment to himself, Ned let himself in the front door as quietly as humanly possible. Fritzy waited, wagging with his whole body. "Shh, good boy," Ned whispered, bending to pat the dog. Maybe he'd make it out back to his new pool before anyone noticed he was home. Adam sailed in first, hopping down the stairs in his Friday green socks, cheeks already flushed with outrage. "The internet is down again. I was in the middle of carburetor repair video on YouTube, and it died." Ned closed his eyes. "The carburetor or the video?" Adam huffed. "It's not funny." "Oh, good. You're home." Ingrid appeared in the foyer. "I have to run back to the office. Those clients from Boston, they want to see the treehouse again. So I've got to put some comps together. You'll need to start dinner. Oh, and the printer is jammed, so I need your help." Ned slipped out of his sneakers, still sandwiched between Adam and Ingrid in the entryway. No one moved. He looked past to the blue promise of pool water through the back windows. "I'll guess I'll start with the printer." Ned was thirsting for that cold beer, but it would have to wait. He squeezed past his family into the kitchen. Adam and Fritzy trailed in tandem. "You need to call the cable company, Adam huffed. "I cannot go on like this." "I think they're closed now, buddy." The printer was at a small workstation in the rear, which Ingrid liked to call the command center. Indeed, the red arrow light was blinking angrily. Ned knew how it felt. He inspected the connections and flipped the printer switch on and off. To Adam, he said, "I'll call the cable company first thing tomorrow." "Tomorrow?" Adam looked ready to pass out. "Still blinking," Ingrid said. Ned checked the paper tray, the ink cartridges, and the connection again. The red light blinked on. "Speaking of tomorrow," Ingrid interjected, "Stan is still shooting that poor scarecrow. Every time I go in the backyard, it's whoop, whoop, whoop. Doesn't feel safe. Maybe we talk to the neighbors or call town hall about regulations. We need to do something." "We," meaning Ned. He smacked the printer hard twice. Miraculously, it hummed to life and light stopped blinking. Ingrid clapped. "Don't forget about dinner." He almost made it to the fridge when Darcy's voice rang out from the doorway. "You're home? So there's this party tonight, and we're more like a gathering, really. Lily really wants to go, even though I could care less. But she's a good friend, and actually I haven't gone out in ages, so I figured." Ned closed his eyes. "Your father needs a minute." There he referred to himself in the third person, and his voice had come out like a sharp rock, but it had the hoped-for effect. All three faces of his loving family stared back at him, unblinking. "Good." He opened the fridge, which retrieved the beer. All three started talking again, voices tumbling over each other like a burst spigot. "I need to give Lily an answer right now. How am I supposed to finish my car video? I need Wi-Fi." "Kids, your father just said." Beer secured, Ned walked wordlessly through the three of them. The dog, more clever than the rest, was already in position by the patio slagger. "Head over, Fritz." Ned slid the door ajar just enough for Fritzy to slip through with him before slamming it closed. The beer was extra cold, and Fritzy found a fat squirrel to chase around the unmown lawn. He was not struck by an arrow sitting poolside. Ned's night was turning around. Around 9:30, Ned padded out of the bathroom in his slippers and made a beeline for bed. That made it through another night. Ingrid had shown the treehouse. Dinner had been served, and even better, Ned had good news to share. "I found Adam a job," he said. Ingrid was already in bed with a book. Fritz curled at her feet. "You did? Doing what?" "Jane needs part-time help in the office, and so does Massimo in the kitchen. I figure Adam can split his day between the two." "That's wonderful, honey. The variety will be good for him." Ned slipped beneath the sheets, feeling hopeful. Adam was down the hall, gaming with a friend. The internet had gloriously restored itself. Darcy was at Lily's. The house was quiet, the bed sumptuous.
So too was Ingrid, whose lovely long legs stretched out from under the covers. Ned had rolled over and reached for his wife when the air began to vibrate. Fritzi's head snapped up. Ingrid groaned. "You've got to be kidding." Ned dragged himself out of the bed and went to the window. Across the way, the Crenshaw's pool was lit up, the lights flashing to a thumping bass. "I'm going over there." "Now?" Ingrid sat up. "I don't think that's a good idea." "So we suffer another sleepless night at Stan Crenshaw holds us hostage in his obnoxious music?" "I got the first scramble of the season tomorrow. I need to be up early." "We're sure it's Stan." Flick confirmed as much at his interview. "Poor kid. He's got to be up early for work tomorrow, too." Ingrid made a face. "Won't this be awkward for Flick if we complain and then he has to see you at work tomorrow?" Ned groaned. He did not point out that he was the one going over to do the complaining. "Yes, Ingrid, Stan Crenshaw is making this awkward for us all, isn't it?" He changed back into clothes and decided to take Fritzi with them. Everyone loved Fritzi. Downstairs at the door, the dog did three insane circles around Ned's feet, entangling both of them in his leash. He never went out this late. Something quite good must be about to happen. As he crossed the dark yard, Ned could not hear the peepers or the rustle of leaves in the summer breeze. Everything was swallowed by the thump, thump, thump of the clamoring bass. He strode to the front door, Fritzi trotting beside him. Ned pressed the doorbell and stepped back. It was deja vu, standing there on the front step. And just like the last time, nobody came to the door. "Well, no wonder," he said to Fritzi. "They can't hear a damn thing either." He pressed the ringer again, holding it for a long time. "They must all be out back," he said. Fritzi whined excitedly. Ned did not want to risk trespassing on the Crenshaw's property in the dark, especially given the crossbow. But he couldn't very well go home either. He needed sleep. And Ingrid would be waiting to hear that he resolved it. And there was the principal, damn it. The Crenshaws need to get with the program on Maple Street. So he strode back across the lawn, across the RV, behind the house, to his own backyard where a privacy fence separated the two properties. It was too tall to peek over, so Ned let Fritz off his leash and found a bucket to stand on. No sooner had Ned climbed atop the bucket when the full picture of debauchery came into view. The entire scene was cast in a purple glow from the pool water to the liquor bottles lining the outdoor bar to the smoking grill that Ned had to admit smelled enticing. People milled around in clusters, some bobbing their heads and moving their hips to the beat. Ned narrowed his eyes. Was that Frank Miller from up the street? An absurd peal of laughter rippled across the pool deck, and Ned recognized the high-pitched voice of Frank's wife, Eileen. At the same time, he recognized her mop of curly dark hair. The Millers were part of this insanity? It was just not possible. Frank Miller was a civil engineer who hated social gatherings, and as far as Ned could tell, most people. Frank never lasted more than 10 minutes at an annual cul-de-sac Christmas party, but here they were. His eyes traveled to a tall, willowy man bent over a table of food. Good grief, was that Jonathan Arbuckle? Jonathan was their head of the neighborhood watch, always getting after people about speed limits and noise pollution. Was it possible he was here to serve a notice, but he got distracted by the chips and dip? But no, there was his wife, Barbara, holding a giant margarita. The whole neighborhood knew Barbara did not drink, not so much as sip of eggnog for the cul-de-sac caroling, and yet, from the way she wobbled across the patio, Barbara was bombed. In the midst of this dubious gathering stood Stan Crenshaw. His big mouth was flapping away in conversation, though Ned wondered how anyone could hear a damn thing he was saying. Apparently, Eileen Miller had exceptional hearing because she threw her curly head back and cackled at whatever Stan said. Astonishingly, others joined in. Loudest of all, Nathan Clumpet, who lived alone with his cat and barely spoke. Was everyone from Maple Street to hear? It was outrageous. Not only were the most antisocial of his neighbors here socializing, bathed in vulgar landscape lighting and de classe company, but there was the glaring fact of the matter. Ned and Ingrid appeared to be the only ones not invited. Awash with fresh irritation, Ned stood taller on his plastic bucket and waved his arms in the direction of the offending host. "Hello, Stan!" Stan did not hear. But Jonathan Arbuckle did. He lifted his face from the chip bowl, looking out for the source. Ned waved again from the side of the fence. "Ned!" Jonathan squinted and ambled over, bowl in hand. "Is that you, Ned?"
"Yes," Ned hissed. "I'm trying to get my neighbor's attention, but he can't hear me over this noise," Jonathan smiled.
"You mean Stan? He's right over there."
"Yes, I can see him, Jonathan."
"He's great," Jonathan stuffed another handful of chips in his mouth, as if Ned was standing at the party with him instead of flailing from the other side of the fence.
"Can you get Stan's attention for me, please? Why don't you come over?"
"Because I wasn't invited," Ned said, standing in the office. "Oh, too bad. Great party." Across the yard, his wife hooted in an unwitting agreement.
"It is?"
Ned wanted to shake Jonathan Arbuckle.
"What would be great if you could let Stan know I'd like a quick word, but please be discreet about it."
Jonathan nodded.
"You bet." Then he turned and cupped his free hand around his mouth. "Hey, Stan! Ned here wants to talk to you."
Head snapped in their direction, eyes squinting through the barbecue haze. Barbara Arbuckle hooted again.
"Ned Birch, is that you?"
Ned forced himself to smile.
"Sorry to interrupt, Stan. If I can, might have a word."
Stan turned down the music but stayed right where he was. Was he really going to challenge Ned to shout across the yard in front of everyone? Ned was debating what to do when finally a small woman with long dark hair walked out of the house with a tray of food. She followed her guest's gaze to the fence.
"Mr. Birch!"
Mercifully, she set the tray down and hurried over. Josie Crenshaw was a pint-sized with a gallon-sized smile.
"I'm so glad to meet you. I want to thank you for hiring Flick."
She had to stand on tiptoes to shake his hand.
"Nice to meet you, too."
Flick is very happy to have a job. It's hard moving to a new town at his age. Her large brown eyes shone as she spoke about her son. Then, as if realizing the awkwardness of the conversation over the fence, her brow furrowed.
"Is there anything I can help you with?"
Ned glanced in the direction of, "Though I hate to interrupt your evening, I'm afraid the music is preventing my wife and me from sleeping. And as you may know from Flick's schedule, Saturdays are the earliest starts of the club."
"Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry." Josie turned and shouted, "Stan, turn the music down."
But Stan was already closing the gap between them. "I already did sweet stuff." Ned could not imagine calling Ingrid that in private or Brooke.
"Something wrong?" Stan asked, turning his unsmiling focus on Ned.
"I just told you." Josie poked his thick side. "The music's keeping the poor neighbors awake."
"That's so."
Ned's bucket wobbled beneath him and he gripped the lip of the fence. "That's so." Then because he liked Flick and Josie seemed so friendly, "we would really appreciate it if you turn it down." Stan crossed his arms. "I would have thought a guy could listen to a little music in his old backyard here in the quiet countryside." Again, with the country stuff, Ned was tempted to bring up the crossbow and ask if he'd shot anything good for dinner. Josie looked between the two men.
"Stan?"
Without taking his eyes off Ned, Stan shrugged. "We'll try to keep it down." Ned forced himself to say it. "Thank you. Enjoy your party." Then, with as much dignity as one can muster from atop a plastic bucket fenced out of a party he was not invited to, Ned lowered himself until the Crenshaw's faces disappeared from view. New chapter, Darcy. "How about we skip stones?" Darcy tried. She was planted in the sand next to Ellie Watson, who was still refusing to go anywhere near the lake. "No." Ellie didn't even look at her. Darcy was losing patience. It was steaming hot out, and for the first time all summer, she was feeling pretty hot herself in her bikini. When she stepped on the scale that morning, she was down 3 more. Her stomach cramped with hunger, or maybe it was the pills working, but whatever. It was working. If only she had the chance to actually get near the water and show off her sacrifices. "What if I twirl you around in the shadow end? We won't go any deeper than a few inches." "No." To make things worse, Darcy heard Spencer Delancey coming up behind her. He must have come down to the beach to swap lifeguard ships with Craig, who'd been in the chair all morning. "Hey, man, I'm sorry I'm late," she heard Spencer say. Darcy didn't dare turn around. "You going to Regan's tonight?" Craig asked. "Yeah, you?" There was a thud of feet landing in the sand as Craig hopped down from the chair. "I've got this stupid family dinner with my grandparents, but I should be able to get out of there by 9. "Cool, it's supposed to be a big one." "He got 2 kegs." Craig smiled. "That should last an hour. Saves me some." So Lily had been right. As soon as she arrived at work that morning, Lily was waiting for her. She overheard that Reagan Rogers, a senior, was hosting, but so far neither she nor Darcy had been able to get any details. Darcy was pretty sure Ashley Wiley would know, but she wasn't about to ask her. What are you two thinking? It was too hot not to be swimming. Spencer was standing with his hands on his tanned hips, looking down at them. She sucked in her stomach and nodded toward Ellie. She says she hates the water. Ellie nodded, unmoved by either of the teenagers staring at Spencer Scott. No one hates the water. I've been trying all week, she told him. From down the beach, Lily was watching them. The girl had radar for Spencer. I've got to keep an eye on my other campers, Darcy said, not wanting to look like she was slacking at the lake, especially in front of a lifeguard. As she went to stand, Spencer held out his hand and she let him pull her up on her feet. She was especially glad to be wearing her good bikini. Thanks, she said, ducking her chin and smiling like she did for a selfie. She sure hoped he wouldn't watch her backside as she walked down to the water. But even worse, Spencer started to walk alongside her. Can she swim? Who knows? Her parents said she can dog paddle, but I can't get her to even take the test. She stole a glance at him and was surprised to see a look of genuine concern. Then I guess that's what we're going to have to do. What? Before Darcy could say anything, Spencer turned and marched back up the beach to where Ellie sat. Darcy watched as he plopped down next to her and tried to start a conversation. She almost laughed when Ellie turned away as if she smelled something bad. Apparently, Spencer's Delancey's charm didn't extend to six-year-old masses. Well, give Ellie time. And then something unreal happened. Spencer said something and Ellie nodded. When he stood up, Ellie did too. Darcy's jaw fell open as he held out his hand, and Ellie Watson took it. She walked with him right past Darcy to the water's edge. Still gripping Spencer's hand at the water's edge, Ellie put on the brakes. You've been listening to The Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Joanne. Thank you for listening.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Are you a Worcester Regional Transit Authority paratransit rider from Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northborough, Oxford, Westborough, or West Boylston? Did you know that you no longer have to call customer service to book your trips? You can now take advantage of our new online reservation system and book your trips online at any time. Call customer service at 508-791-9782. Or email paratransit@therta.com to set up your online account to begin scheduling your trips. Please note the online reservation system is an additional option for your convenience. You can still call customer service to book your trips.